Okay, let's go ahead and get started. We have a special guest today, but I'll let him introduce himself because he has a very interesting story to tell. But what's going on this week?
Engineers.
So what's after class? What activity are you heading to?
Work on senior design. That's the activity.
Besides that, that's ethics competition, right?
Yes.
And what's tomorrow?
Lunch.
And what else?
Tomorrow's fantastic Friday.
We have t-shirt competition. I'm thinking the competition's not too stiff right now. Are there any t-shirts posted yet?
I don't know.
And and then we're having the research poster competition as well.
Yes, Friday.
And some undergrads are presenting at that, so please support that. And did we do the brown bag? How did the brown bag go yesterday?
We still aren't sure the results yet. They
built the robot. It was good.
Okay.
They built the car. It was good.
All right. So what?
Yeah, we have the most participation so far. ASCD, Vision the Gap competition.
Good.
Yeah.
Get it up, those candy boys.
What's happening next Tuesday?
Presentations.
Presentations, okay. So I'm going to talk today about test plans, but first, we've talked a lot in this class about how design is a very multidisciplinary issue. Well, I think you're going to hear from somebody who has a much different view of what design is all about, but this is actually very much relevant to the kinds of issues we deal with in senior design. And you're going to hear about an event that is coming up next month. Welcome.
All right. Okay. Good afternoon. I am Professor Youngjin Yu from Fox School of Business, and I run direct a center called Center for Design Plus Innovation. My background is integrating digital technology into products and services to help people to think about a different future, kind of thing. And one of the things that we are very interested in is applying these three things, design, technology, and management in the domain of urban renewal, urban innovation. Temple University is one of few public urban institutions. We are at the heart of North Philly. If you think about cities, this is a global challenge. This is a global opportunity at the same time. Every generation has their own generational challenge. Your father's generation, it was Cold War. And the way they responded to it was through science and technology. The great universities that we know became great because those universities responded through their intellectual response, building new science program, engineering program, essentially building weapons to defend ourselves from Soviet Union and communist countries. One of the great generational challenges that we face is urban problems, urbanization. As you may know, more than 50% of world populations live in cities, some form. And so what we have here in Philadelphia is a great opportunity to experiment with lots of great ideas that you all have and turn it into a business solution that not only make money, but also help real problems. Problems that we have day to day, public transportation, safety, job creation, education, public health, these are all the domains that we can think about. So why am I talking about this? Well, next month, right after your spring break, we are hosting what we call Design Challenge. This is campus-wide Design Challenge. We are working together with the City of Philadelphia. We hope all of you will participate either as a team or as an individual. If you enter as an individual, we will team you up with others from other schools, or you can form a team, preferably either representing student club or recruiting students from another school on campus, or maybe a couple people from other local schools. That's fine, as long as majority of the team members represent Temple students. Or, as I said, you can enter as an individual. The challenge is to think about North Broad Street from Center City Campus and City Hall, Main Campus, and Health Science Center of Temple University. This is the zone that we created, what we call North Broadband. North Broad Street, and then broadband is coming, and so we just came up with that idea. So the idea is, how can we turn this North Broad Street as a urban digital innovation hotbed? What are some of the things that you can imagine that we do together with the city, other companies, and as well as the university assets? We have tremendous resources on campus, intellectual, human, financial, and technological assets. City also has a lot of untapped resources. They have enormous digital assets. They have one of the largest GIS departments. They are digitally tagging every object on in the city. They have large database about streets and buildings and so on. Most of these are actually kept private, hidden from the purview of citizens. So the idea is, can we turn it into some kind of resources that you all can creatively think about mobilizing and then create some ideas? So not only we want you to think about, some examples could be creating a application, or think about a bus shelter all along the North Broad Street. Right now it is pretty dumb, physical bus shelter. Can we turn that into some kind of a smart bus shelter that may interact with people who are passing by, the incoming buses, departing buses, nearby business and the neighborhoods? You know, what is that that thing, the smart bus shelter, might offer in terms of services, as solving particular problems, as well as what is the business proposition so that that operation can continue without continuing support from the city? So, challenge all of you to think outside of the box, not only thinking about engineering exercise, that is design, but you also need to design a business organization, business model, if you will. So you have a great idea, physical object and software, but then you need to, attach that with some kind of business model. And that's why we encourage you to work with students from other schools. If you have friends at Fox School, go talk to them and form your team. We are also sending out the challenge to the students at Tyler. So, the thing that you design should look good, right? Apple's iPhone user interface looks pretty good. Anybody can understand it. So even if it is really engineering sort of sense very good, if the user interface is not really good from an aesthetic standpoint, it may not be very good. So you may want to go and talk to some of your friends in Tyler School, and so that you can work together. Maybe you want to talk to, the architecture students, as you think about the space, actually physical space. So the idea is, the opportunity is wide open. You can think about new government services, business model, their taxpayers' money coming in, and government come up with new kind of services using technology that you can think of. Or you can think about a new education service, public school system. Maybe they can come up with new tablet application that integrates, what kids do at school and connect with what parents do. I don't know. There are a lot of different ways that you can think about it. So that's the challenge. So I all, encourage all of you to consider entering the competition. Website is incredibly easy to remember. It's design.temple.edu. Anybody can remember that. And then the last day of competition, that competition begins on Monday, so that is the kickoff day. Tuesday, Wednesday, your team will study on your own. You will go out and survey what's available on Broad Street. We'll give you a packet of resources that you can think about from the city, from the university, and then some other private sector resources that we think you should think about. We'll also make an arrangement for you to interview local residents, some of the hospitals and local community organizations, so that you can visit to understand what they need. So kind of like a quick user requirement analysis. And then all day Thursday, we have reserved a room at Alto Hall, top floor. We'll turn it into a workshop, so that you will bring all of your research together with your team members, and then you will follow facilitation throughout the day, and then you will actually build your final prototype and presentation during the day. So you really don't need to do a lot of work ahead of time. You can actually do the research and then come together on Thursday, and then you will produce your outcome. You will present, the winning team will receive $1,000 cash prize. The second winner will get $500, and third place will get the recognition and paper. And then the final day, the Friday, we have all-day conference. Of course, we will give the award. But we have invited really exciting set of speakers. Mayor Noda is coming as one of the speakers, not just a customary, you know, welcome remark, but he will actually speak about his view on design and why design is important for city and Philadelphia. We have, I don't know whether some of you know a company called Top Quarter. It is really interesting company among programmers community. They create software design challenge for commercial purpose. So the company and organization like NASA come to them and say, we have this software problem, and then they turn it into global software development challenge with cash prize, and then programmers all over the world compete for that pride and prize. So the CEO is coming and he wants to partner with us next year for this design challenge to make it as a global challenge for through his network. So again, we have excellent speakers, IBM, Electronic Inc., local company for software development, and then a whole bunch of people who have very interesting and exciting story to tell. So I want you to all come. It's free all day. We have food. You have ample opportunity to network, learn from each other. Of course, we want you to be part of the design challenge. Even if you don't participate in the design challenge, you can still come on Friday. Question?
The design challenge, does the winning team have any prospects of actually getting their design to use?
Right, so there will be judges and coaches, and there will be a couple of those who represent a venture capital community. So these are the people who actually look for good ideas. And then the reason that we do it is that city actually is, you know, seriously thinking that they actually have a plan for North Philadelphia development plan. So we want to use this as an opportunity to really crowdsource good ideas. And then, you know, the idea is that we will have students to continue to work and develop, be part of the final project. So there's absolutely a real opportunity for this thing to grow as a real, you know, entrepreneurship opportunity. So thank you for the question. Any other questions? If not, I hope all of you to go to the website, design.temple.edu, after class. Don't do it during the class. All right. I have some brochures and postcards, so you can pick them up, and then shoot me an email if you have any questions. All right? Thanks.
How many reasons you want to attend these kinds of things has to do with the networking piece? The kind of networking you can do at these kinds of events is really pretty amazing, because you're talking to often the CEOs or the people who make a lot of significant decisions for companies, and you'd be surprised how important those kinds of connections can be. So, and this is actually an interesting activity. You're going to hear more about his center and about some of the things we're doing together, because he's very well connected to a number of the major design think tanks in the country. And I've also worked with some of those companies indirectly, and these are really your top-notch designers. Some of these designers are people designing things like iPods for Apple and cars for GM and that kind of thing. There are a couple companies that, it turns out, do nothing but job shop design to all these different industries, and there's kind of a group of these people who are really pretty world-famous, and some of them are going to be represented at this conference.
Are they talking about buying out all the people who live in that area and modernizing?
No, we say that in public now.
Well, that's what I'm asking, like, what kind of design? Are they actually, like, talking about modernizing that whole area?
Well, so the plan is for, you may have heard the president talk a little bit about this, the Avenue of the Arts. They're calling this something like the Northern Avenue of the Arts. The plan is for, from downtown all the way up to the med school, to become a high-tech kind of corridor. This is one of the reasons why the president wants to build the library on Broad Street to kind of kickstart this. One of the reasons, when I came to Temple, one of my first observations was whenever you have a med school located a couple miles from the main campus, what invariably happens is the two grow and merge. So from here to the med school, with probably within 10 to 20, easily within 20 years, maybe faster than that, someday we'll be all Temple. Up and down Broad. That's just sort of inevitable as both organizations keep growing. I just heard, in fact, that they're going to I talked earlier in the semester about they're going to demolish the high-rises, public housing high-rises that are over here. I just found out yesterday that Temple actually bought that land. And then I heard something even more interesting, some speculation that they were thinking about things like football stadium maybe, or parking lots, or various things. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of people speculating about real estate in the area. But it's complicated issues. I don't know if I passed the story along, but when you look at population trends right now, for a while inner cities were growing. Now inner cities have actually declined a little bit, and what they call there's the suburbs and the exurbs, and the suburbs, the near end suburbs, are doing really well right now. The rejuvenation of urban environments has slowed a little bit, but that's going to change this year when gas prices spike again. Every time gas prices spike, then everyone starts talking about rejuvenation of urban areas. In the public housing, this is way out of my job description, but my understanding is they'll be offered or relocated in a nice way to other public housing. The trend these days is to build a low-rise public housing like they have south and east of campus. So I believe they've already been in the process of moving. I'm sorry?
They closed it all. They did it now.
Yeah, it's clear.
Wait, I'm sorry?
But they closed it all already.
What? That's what I was going to say, is I think this has been going on for a while. I'm not really current on this, but I don't know how many residents still live in those high-rises, but they're supposed to demolish them. And I believe they're building new, there's a plan to build new low-rise public housing in the area also. So the university, as you know, is very sensitive about not crowding out neighborhoods and things like that. So, but if you look up and down Broad Street, there's a lot of properties that's underutilized. Come to the thing and listen to Mayor Nutter talk about this stuff. They'll probably be addressing what the long-term plan is. There are a lot of interesting pieces of the long-term plan for the city of Philadelphia. I had a chance to talk to some of the city planners a while ago, about a couple months ago. And one of the things I'm excited about is the idea of extending the subway out to the Naval Shipyards. That's in the plan. And that'll be really good for Temple. But anyway, that doesn't get you graduated. So let's talk about. So I did this survey of what I should talk about in this class, and one of the productive pieces of feedback that came back was test plans. So let's talk a little bit about how to write a test plan. So who writes a test plan? Let's start with some basics.
People.
The lead engineer of the project, right?
George.
You will not write a test plan. I'll make it easy.
The lead engineer of the project.
Yep.
So you're gonna grow. If you're design engineers, you're gonna grow to hate the test engineers. If you're a test engineer, well, you're gonna be used to everybody hating. But test engineers, I tell you, they can shut you down overnight because they come in, set up the tests, and define the terms. And when you fail, God help you. There have been several good examples of this. One of the ones that I remember a few years ago was that one of these, if you remember with the first Gulf War, everybody was really concerned about Scud missiles and all that, and they started a development of anti-missile missiles or anti-missile missiles, whichever one, and they did a flight test out in the Pacific Ocean. They shot seven missiles, all seven missed. If you work in that sector, this is like your worst nightmare, because when that happens, I can tell you what you're going to be doing for 18 hours a day for the next year, and that's preparing for your next flight test. But that test was designed not by the company developing the missiles, but by people who wanted an objective evaluation of the technology, and the technology failed. And when that happens, that's a real problem. So there's a lot of money and time that goes into developing and executing test plans. This is something we don't really teach much about in engineering coursework, but I tell you, you're going to spend a lot of time on this in industry. So let's talk a little bit about that. So what must be included in your test specifications? There's three general sections, really two. There's an introduction which tries to define the goal and the scope of how much you're going to be responsible for testing. Then there's the test plan itself, which describes the tests you're going to, the test plan describes sort of the, as it indicates, the test plan. And then there's the actual test procedures that describe in great detail how you're going to conduct the tests. There's different types of tests that you run. There's unit tests, sometimes we'll call those component testing. Then there's integration testing. How does it all fit together? Then there's validation testing. How does the overall system meet your design constraints? And then there's high order testing, which I don't even remember what that stands for. And by the way, this is not my presentation. This is one of the links I sent you in email about an hour ago. If you're interested in test plans for your specific project, just do some Googling. You'll be amazed at how many documents like this there are out on the net that you can use as models to develop your documents. So, in the test specification, what are the major items? Well, you have the introduction, which provides an overview of the entire test. This document describes both the test plan and test procedure. Then you have goals and objectives. Overall goals and objectives of the test process are described. A lot of this stuff is usually boilerplate. Statement of scope. Now, a lot of this testing, at least from my experience, since I work in software, this is a big part of software. When you develop software, you have to have very, very detailed test plans. And these test plans describe essentially what we call use cases, how people will actually use the software and such. But for hardware systems also, you'll have very similar kinds of tests. But some of what we talk about today will be talked about in the framework of software testing. But these principles apply, of course, to all engineering projects. This section will also have your major constraints. And we talk a lot about constraints within senior design, so that should be very familiar to territory for you. What is the main goal of your test section or your evaluation section in your design document? What's the overarching goal of that section? What do you have to convince us by the end of second semester, by the end of that section?
That you designed your system to match your constraints?
No, not design. That's the approach.
You're able to prove that you've sufficiently...
able to prove?
Yeah. That you proved.
Thank you. The point of this section, by the end, and this is probably the acid test for senior design too. By the end of that test section, I have to be convinced your system met the design constraints. And the testing section really sets up the way you're going to convince me of that. Now, if you're wise, normally in a real world setting or an industrial setting, you will of course negotiate with the test engineers long before you ever run these tests. I would encourage you to negotiate with your course coordinators as well, so that they feel comfortable that the tests you plan to run are going to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that your system meets its design constraints. And what's the biggest problem in senior design? Well, the biggest problem is a lot of projects never get to the point where you can test them. And so you take a double hit. You take a double hit just for not finishing the project and then not having the test data. That's why we're pushing the hardware prototypes early in the semester to get you to the point where you can do some decent testing. So once you get past the introduction, the next section is the test plan itself. This section describes the overall testing strategy and the project management issues that are required to execute the effective tests. How many of you have allocated time for testing in your schedules? Yeah, not too many. These are not the kinds of things you can get done the night before your final presentation. These take time, they take equipment, they take preparation. Then you'll have a section where you describe exactly what's to be tested. Then you'll have a section on the overall testing strategy. And we'll break that down into unit testing. So why did we have you do block diagrams? What? Why did we have you do block diagrams?
So we were subsystems.
So you break your bigger project down into subsystems. What's an ideal situation, ideal decomposition in terms of those subsystems? And let's talk maybe specifically first about software, since I think everybody can relate a little bit to that. What's the difference between integration testing and unit testing when we talk about software? Let's try to be get very specific for a moment. Chris?
Making sure, like if you're building a big piece of software, you like testing one function out prior to dumping it inside of the program.
Exactly. So normally when you write software, you break the task down into lots of smaller tasks, and those tasks will be implemented in terms of subroutines or function calls. And why that's important is because then people can go off and develop those functions independently. This is how you do group software development, how you accelerate the pace at which you develop software. Every one of those modules will have tests associated with them so that those developers can independently debug and test their modules. That's what we call unit testing. And usually the first step in finalizing your software is to make sure that it all passes unit testing. In fact, there are software packages out there now that will automatically generate the unit tests for you. This is one of the neat things about Java, is there's software that will actually, from your code, generate tests automatically. And some of you, if you go into software development, will see this. Once the unit testing's done, then you start testing the higher level application. And that again can often be done in various stages. But the final stage is where you'll actually have users sitting in front of the software, and they will be following documents which literally say things like, press this button, type in this text, press that button, bring that menu down. This is how specific these tests are. And I've been involved in environments where we've argued a lot about these tests. Invariably, and I'll talk about this in a moment, but what happens is as you find bugs or as you find problems, when you submit bug reports to software developers for packages that you've had problems with, what do you think happens to those bug reports? Besides, after that. Well, they usually ignore them because they've probably gotten 50,000 of the same thing. But the process of reporting bugs is actually a very important part of the testing process. One of the things that happens with those bug reports is they actually get incorporated into unit tests. They will take the conditions of that bug and turn it into a test. Either a unit test or an end-user test. And that's part of the whole feedback process of trying to make sure you have a rigorous set of tests for your system. So unit testing, you're testing at the component level. That should roughly correspond to the blocks in your block diagram. Hopefully, if you've done a nice, clean decomposition, those blocks can be done in parallel. They're independent of one another. If you've done a very bad decomposition, the blocks are all independent and the decomposition is not really a decomposition. So that's another example of why we push this concept of a block diagram. Once you've done all the unit testing, then you'll do the integration testing. And that, is kind of obvious, involves testing the whole system. And then you'll do validation testing. And so that's the test plan. Now with the test, so the test plan sort of defines what you're going to test. It defines the test cases. The test procedures now go into great detail and describe exactly how you're going to test things. So the test plan may say something like, you have to demonstrate that a file can be opened, modified, and closed. That may be a test case. But the test procedure will actually say exactly what you should do, exactly what steps you'll follow. Type this, do that, go to this directory, that kind of thing. Now, why are the test procedures so important? And again, let's maybe focus initially on software. What have you all experienced with software in terms of bugs?
Locked up.
One of the most basic types of bugs that happens to anybody is you encounter a bug, right? And you say, okay, I got to go talk to my system administrator, or I have to go talk to whoever's responsible for the software. And you say, my software doesn't do X, Y, Z. We went through this with Fluent, right? We had weeks of this with this Fluent ANSYS package. And what does the system administrator usually say?
What procedure did you follow to have this bug down?
No. Invariably, they say, well, it works for me. Here, I'll do the same thing. And they sit there. It's really embarrassing. They sit there and they go through the same steps and it works. Right? And the reason it works on their machine and doesn't work on your machine is involved in the test procedure. If you don't write the test procedure specific enough, the conditions of the two tests are completely different. He or she may be running as administrator with special privileges. This is a very common thing that happens in Windows. And therefore, they can get through all sorts of privilege violations and things like that. Or that you may have other processes running on your machine that they don't have. So a test procedure will talk about exactly what the state of the system should be before you start the test.
How can we relate this to civil engineering?
How can we relate this to civil engineering? give me an application.
Slab design.
Cement slab design. Is that what we're talking about?
Concrete, yeah.
Concrete. My favorite topic. Because, and you're not going to believe this, when I was standing in front of the train station this morning.
Okay. You love the train.
I love the
train station stores.
No, I was actually putting on my coat before I climbed up the stairs, and I'm looking at this faceted concrete that they have, nice little patterned concrete, and it's nice and smooth and everything, which I can never get to do. But I'm looking, and it's like, on this section, there's all these cracks. On the next section, there's not all these cracks. And on the next section, there's all these cracks. And I'm looking, okay, so there must be some structural thing going on here. No, they were all pretty much three similar structural situations. I didn't see anything really anomalous.
Okay.
So why did two out of those three crack? I'm sure when they designed this and tested and all that, they said these things weren't going to crack for 50 years. So this is where you get into test procedures. They no doubt built samples with the concrete they were proposing to use for this, brought it to SEPTA or whoever, and they tested those samples of the concrete for PSI and structure, or whatever they do, bending and all that stuff. But those test procedures don't exactly replicate the situation when they actually poured this concrete, mixed it and poured it. And who knows, maybe the sand that came in at the time had some property to it or something. So I think with material mixing, and that's something I'll talk about next lecture when we talk about sort of statistical analysis of tests and things, when you talk about these kinds of tests, you have to be very specific about the starting point, the initial conditions, including the qualities of all your materials, the humidities, temperatures, all this kind of stuff, to make sure that when you actually execute, that what you're getting maps exactly what the users are going to see. And I think this is actually a big problem in... you can't get me started to talk about concrete. So I lived off of Sessoms Road. Sessoms Road in Mississippi, and you go look it up on the map, has been perpetually failing for like 30 years. Because it's built on top of some gumbo, or whatever they call this stuff. It's this really moisture-laden soil. And they've made, in the last 30 years, three attempts to pave this road. And every one of those attempts has failed within a year or two of the road being finished. And the last one I was watching very closely because by that time I was living down this road. And I was talking to the engineers about it. And it was really interesting, all the arguments about what kind of roadbed they needed, when they took core samples. You know, they said, well, the civil engineers came out and took core samples, and the county decided we only needed like a 4-foot bed or of crushed rock or something. And of course, the engineer I'm talking to for the company says, we wanted to actually go twice that, because we told them this road was going to crater before it was even finished. And they said they didn't want to pay the extra money. They said, we hired our civil engineers. They took the core samples. They said, this is what you need. I'm simplifying, but. And sure enough, that road, by the time they finished it, it was cratering. I mean, cratering really badly. And there was a lot of, you know, it's a tough problem because the soil was built under.
So as an engineer, even if you do all your homework and you present, you know, the best design, and, you know, you have the testing procedure, it's not necessarily in your hands in the end.
No, absolutely not.
That affects your reputation, though.
Absolutely. This is what I'm trying to draw out with some of these disasters. I hate to always talk about disasters, but very often when a shuttle blows up, they point the fingers at the contractors. Every time. When a bridge collapses, they point the fingers at the contractors. The contractors will show you the documents that said they ran the tests and the funding organization signed off on those tests. And yet the contractor wound up in court getting sued by somebody. Why? Because the contractor is the one who has the money.
So does that go back to the contract itself? I mean, if it's on
it gets
them,
very complicated.
Right.
It gets very complicated because the lawyers can't sue, you know, the plaintiffs, the people who got killed or their families can't sue the government, more or less. So they have to go after the contractors. The contractors work under contract to the government, which means when they deliver that structure or whatever, you know, there's a stack of documents about testing. And every one of those have been passed. I mean, governments are really particular about this.
So how do you steer clear of situations like that?
It's what? You never get away from lawsuits, and you will settle lawsuits even though you're not at fault.
Right.
And that's really, as engineers, I find that really disgusting. But you know, that's business. But this is really why it's important. You will spend, as project managers or lead engineers, you're going to spend a lot of time arguing with test engineers about the details of the testing. Many of you as senior engineers, that's going to be your primary function. It's not. You'll have junior engineers actually developing the technology, but your function as project manager or project lead is to make sure all the pieces of the project come together properly.
So when we look at a block diagram, we have individual components. We write the test procedure for individual components.
Right.
So we have the test procedure and the test specifications for each one of those.
Right.
Then we write the same thing, or not the same thing, we write another test procedure and specification for the whole integration.
For the whole system, exactly. I will tell you that we, in my personal software development, we have a large body of software where there's probably about 100,000 functions, software functions. Every one of those functions has a unique set of test specs. When we deliver our software to somebody, they type make and then they type make test. Make test runs through every one of those tests. And it's simple math stuff, like if this is a matrix routine. It says, you know, here's the input, here's what the output should be, run it. If you don't get that output, report an error. So we do all that unit testing. Then we put the system together and we run a real test, like a speech recognition application, which is what I develop. And we also have regression tests on that. 9 times out of 10, in fact, almost every time when we do a new software release, even after we've done all this unit testing, the integration test will fail. It always fails. Because you never foresee every possible condition in these unit tests. I don't know how much trouble you're having with Word 2010, but I'm having terrible problems with Word 2010. And I know people at Microsoft, I know their software development procedures. Microsoft, despite what you think, is one of the world's leader in doing software engineering. But the catching, the integration testing is really important because it catches all sorts of stuff that you don't ever think about. And you know, there's obviously parallels to almost any other kind of technology with this type of thing. That engineering systems, if you think about them from a statistical sense, they're a combination of lots of little modules. The probability of a failure goes up almost exponentially as you start integrating more and more modules. So if the more complex your system, the more guaranteed you are to have a failure at the integration level. Now, one of the tricks, they allude to that a little bit here, one of the tricks in testing is a lot of times you want to do unit testing, but the rest of the system won't actually be ready for testing. We have that with some of the teams doing large structural things where they want to make some decisions about low-level issues, but they won't really have put them all together yet for quite a while. And that's where we get into things like how you can specify ways to test this software without actually having the higher-level system put together yet. And that's sometimes what's called stubs or component or drivers or components and such. So integration testing, we talked a little bit about validation testing. I don't think you have to pay too much attention to this in this class, but another whole aspect of testing is you will do unit testing, and again, this is sort of from a software point of view, you will do unit testing with the particular version of the software that you're using when you develop. So you'll have a copy of the code base sitting on your PC, and you'll be doing a lot of testing with that. Or you may have a physical system in your laboratory and you're doing your testing of structures and things in your lab. And then you'll do the integration testing in a test lab. But when it comes to actually validating the system, now you're going to ship this software to somebody else and they're going to install it on their machine and have to do all, and you have to guarantee that it's going to work in their environment. So it's not good enough to establish that you can mix concrete in your laboratory here in Philadelphia when the job is going to be out in the middle of the Sahara Desert or something.
Rodney? How can Microsoft possibly have all the integrated testing possible with all the different software and hardware out there and expect excellent results?
What do you think the ratio, how many true software developers do you think, what do you think the ratio of true software developers is at Microsoft to other people like test engineers? Most of you I know are thinking the development positions are probably dominant. Microsoft, let's say if they have 1,000 employees, 900 of them are lead developers. No, they do testing internally. How many people do you think there are who actually design an Intel microprocessor?
Probably only a handful.
We always like to talk about this. There's only a lot of students who go to school to become chip designers and things. There's only about 6 people in the world who actually design microprocessors. And there's probably about 100,000 engineers who work in that industry or more. And most of them are doing testing and other kinds of support functions like that.
How did those 6 people get to that point?
They own the company.
They are 6 really, really smart people who have earned their way, you know, worked their way up, being identified as being top-notch talent. Not quite, but you will, if you go to these kinds of technology companies, well, you know, look at Steve Jobs, for example. He's kind of a unique case in many ways, but he has personally been lead engineer on a lot of Apple's biggest products.
Have you ever met any of those people?
I've met some of them. I haven't met Jobs.
Okay.
I know people. We used to, when I was at Texas Instruments, we dealt with Joe before he was the big guy. We didn't take him seriously back then. our TI CEO would not even talk to him back then because they thought he was some punk. Hot attitude. So we were trying to sell them DSPs. I think I told this story, and I would hear about the meetings. I didn't get to go to them personally, but he was no big deal back then. But he swore. Well, it's a long story. I'll tell you offline. But every company has these. They have one or two lead engineers. A friend of mine is now lead engineer at TI for all their DSP business, and he's responsible. He kind of is the guy. But the point in engineering is there's a lot more to engineering than what you think is the core design function. Most of you, if you go into technology companies, your first jobs are either going to be support or testing. And then you're going to work your way up and kind of demonstrate that you're good enough to actually have the responsibility of doing design, the real design.
Going back to the architect, the thing about block diagram and testing, within the block diagram, the sub-block diagram, we have parts that we bought, and then we're integrating certain components. Do we test the parts that we bought or the integration of the things?
That's a good question. If you want, what was I talking about? Maybe it was the senior design one last week. So I lived in a state where we competed to get auto manufacturing facilities. That's where I learned all this. We got the Nissan plant when I was in Mississippi State. Our university actually played a role in that. Why are they so eager to get an auto company manufacturing plant? This plant may bring maybe 4,000 jobs if you're lucky.
Taxes.
And it may cost them about $1 billion to win with all the incentives and breaks they're going to get. Why do states kill each other to get auto company manufacturing
for the support companies?
What happens? What happens when you build an auto a manufacturing plant?
Creates its own economy.
Why?
Because those other companies award contracts to other companies. Those other companies want to be able to go back and forth between each
so
other.
So what happens when?
It's all about proximity.
Where are those companies located, though? There's an answer to your question coming. Just give me another minute.
Were they originally located?
No. When they agree to do business with it, when they agree to supply parts to that specific manufacturing facility,
they're right down the street.
You have to commit as a second tier supplier to building a facility right outside the auto manufacturing plant. So what happens is right, literally across the road from that plant, all sorts of business parks spring up, and all sorts of companies locate manufacturing facilities there. Why? That's the answer to your question.
So they supply parts for auto integration.
But why do the auto companies want them right across the street?
Just in time.
They don't do testing.
Ask some questions.
Because they walk across the street, and what do they do?
Work. This is
the what?
They observe the testing and make sure that they're complying with their standards.
They make sure that those parts, before they even enter the door of the manufacturing facility, meet their specifications. And they don't want to just take a piece of paper like a senior design document that says we meet your specifications. They want to see it.
I'm talking about commissioning testing. I mean, if I want to use their product in my system, do I make sure that the product works?
I'm getting to you. You're not listening to my answer. How is that any different than what I just described? You want to buy mufflers from Mufflers or Us. You're just going to let them ship you 100,000 mufflers and then 5 years later find out they rust in the snow of Philadelphia here?
How do I know the manufacturer's not playing a statistical game? I mean, you would have run 100% tests on every single supplier.
So what do you think you do? Do you take the word of your supplier?
No.
You test them yourself.
You test them yourself. Because when you go to your Six Sigma training, which all of you, I'm sure, will go to quality control training classes, when you do that, one of the first things they tell you is to improve the quality of what comes out the door. The very first thing is to make sure what comes in the door meets the requirements. Now, this is important because many of you are going into the lab and doing measurements like you're mixing cement out of sand and rock and this and that. But none of you, and I really beat on students last semester, are doing measurements on the properties of those materials you're mixing. That's part of your test plan. That's part of your test specification. You've got to know what's going in before you can predict what's going out. So when you buy those parts, this is a very delicate thing because, you know, you look at Toyota, all of their problems, and how much of those were attributed to suppliers not providing the right things, and how much of those were attributed to themselves. But they gave specs to those suppliers. Those suppliers claimed they were meeting specs.
Did they have like 10,000 suppliers for like each car or something?
Yeah, I mean, it's just an enormous industry, and that's why you'll have 10,000 test engineers sitting over that kind of stuff.
So where did they go wrong?
It's both places. I was reading a book. There's a book, popular book out now called Poorly Made in China. And I'm not picking on China, but they talk about the fact that Chinese manufacturers routinely change the chemical mixtures of things without telling the American businesses who are buying that stuff. They'll ship you a pallet of stuff, and they won't even tell you that they changed the mixture on it because they've never been manufactured in a culture where they had to perform to those kinds of specifications. So when you see, they told a lot of interesting stories in this book. They said, well, when those pallets of shampoo bottles got stored in a warehouse in the U.S. that was 90 degrees Fahrenheit, the labels fell off the bottles. Why did the labels fall off the bottles? They found out after the fact that they changed the glue mixture.
It was cheaper,
and it was never tested up to 90 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's why a lot of products, they won't even let you buy China steel.
It's, you know, there are a lot of interesting globalization issues on this stuff. So does that answer your question? So now I don't expect you, if you're buying, you know, parts from DigiComp Key or something, I don't expect you to set up test labs to, you know, test that your resistors are actually, you know, compliant. But these are the kinds of things you have to think about. The main thing I want to see, and that's why I pointed you to the document that I did from one of our teams here in Senior Design. I want to see very detailed descriptions of your test setups. Don't be afraid. This is one time where you can go into as much detail as you want. Tell us you were eating a sandwich while you measured, use the oscilloscope. That's fine. I'll take it.
It was raining outside. It was raining outside when I tested this.
But, you know, go in and tell us the equipment, the model numbers, the settings, all that kind of detail.
Dr. Russell, bacon, and Joe's spice.
All right, well, there's just a case study here. Since I put this online, I won't go through this today, but
you should.
There's a nice case study here that gets bacon. A little more into specifics about what you might include in some of these specific sections and stuff. But like I said, the document that I sent you, which was from Terra Thermal team, was very good. The test section there had a really good amount of detail. Maybe they could use a little more boilerplate stuff and wrapping around it. But in terms of describing very specifically what a test specification is, they did a really good job.
What do you mean when you say boilerplate?
Well, intro, you know, goals and scope and that kind of stuff. I mean, okay. But when you actually get down to the test procedures, test procedures is what we're really looking at. And those we want to be very, very specific. Much like your lab reports or that, you know, that kind of level of specificity. Okay? All right, so next Tuesday, it's showtime.
Is it here?
And it'll be in here. The room numbers are on the spreadsheets.
What time do you have to...